This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight we're going to be talking with Gary Evans, and Gary has some really interesting stuff he's been working on over the last couple of years. And we did an extra segment for him for patrons only as well. If you want to become a patron of the show, it's only $3 a month, and you'll get extra content. You'll get first shot at merchandise, which I'm working on putting together now. Some of it may even be free for you. We'll see how things go, but you'll definitely get it as a discount as well, plus extras from many of our guests. The interviews themselves will always be free. You know, it's all about spreading information and getting it out there. The archives will also be free and are now. You can go right back to our first show on the archives on www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. I will be setting up a members section for people who are patrons, and maybe make a couple other options in case you don't like the patron setup. All right, enough about that. This is my talk from about a week ago with Gary Evans. All right, we are here again after, what did we say, 2.5 years with Gary Evans. How you doing, Gary?
It's good to be back. Yeah, we've left it perhaps a bit too long, but I'm sure we do well.
You have been doing a lot of stuff in that time period.
Yes. Yeah. Well, now I realize how long it is since we spoke. we've certainly moved a lot of the areas that we last discussed forwards, which is the good news.
Now, the last time you were on, we were talking about ancient acoustics and the effects on consciousness and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you said a lot of the science that's been coming out has backed that up.
Yeah, well, I really started looking into the science deeply because I was going to give some presentations, and I wanted to verify another source of verification that these experiences I've had and shared with groups had. What was the foundation? Is there a foundation in science? And yeah, well, it doesn't actually take very long to find a lot of validation. Princeton, there was the PEAR group there that, I mean, this is research going back a few decades, but there's some interesting papers on the Princeton website from the PEAR group about acoustics and ancient sites and the pattern that they'd seen back then around the world, and how they would, how they basically agreed that one of the conclusions was that you would expect some kind of mystical experience at some of these ancient sites using acoustics. So that was very interesting to read. And there's the research of Miriam A. Kolar at Stanford, who I've been in touch with a few times via email. She's doing some very interesting acoustic mapping of these chambers down in Peru at a site called Chavin. So you can actually see with directional microphones how the sound flows around inside these chambers, and you can then see that it's done by design. So she's been doing some very interesting work. And there's some other research coming out of Europe that's still ongoing. So, yeah, it's been a good investigating period.
And it seems like with all these different sites having the same technology there, it's not something they would have stumbled on by accident.
No. Well, basically, if you don't try and look at all of these ancient sites around this time period that, as best as we know, is sort of 2,500 BC to 3,000 BC. I mean, I'm here in the south of France at the moment, and I see the same sort of level of technology dated to the same period as I see in England, And again, we see these things in Central America, and it's in Egypt. And when you start looking, you find out it's worldwide. So this was a worldwide knowledge of this technology, which we're still trying to back engineer, because it was definitely integrating with sort of natural forces and on what we call earth energies, which we're now starting to be able to measure with electronic equipment.
What kind of equipment are we using to measure this stuff?
Well, there's a number of ways. I mean, just a simple, the voltage that comes through different types of rock. So you can see a variance. Electromagnetism, some rocks more electromagnetic than others. And, actually, since I last met you, I went into Hollywood and pitched a TV show concept where we'd get some sort of higher level measuring equipment. And because I'm confident enough with my sort of inner sensitivity, I believe I could direct people with this electronic measuring equipment in the right direction. So that's something I've got in the pipeline at the moment. And we're just really deciding on how much of the human element would be involved and how much of the kind of the geology and the sort of scientific side, because it's a delicate balance. But yeah, there's plenty of these subtle energies in the earth that you can measure, but you can also measure the physiological effects on the human body. So heart rate and the sort of cortisol levels in the blood to see if stress has been reduced, and maybe even do something on looking at the activity in the mind. You can kind of get some portable equipment to even look at that side of it now. So there's quite a few options.
Now, when you say earth energy, are you talking like ley lines or just different spots with different type of anomalous energy?
Well, the ley lines side of it, a lot of people talk about and look into, and it is a bit harder to prove it scientifically, but you can certainly say that in certain types of geology where you can measure the energies that we were discussing coming up, those kind of the ground current and the electromagnetism, which in my opinion definitely seems to have an effect on our state of mind. So that side of it, when you look at the geology and you can see the sort of fractures in different types of rock, and so these subtle energies can come up to the surface, and like Sedona has a lot of iron, so you get this red rock that looks more conductive, of course. So these kind of things are easier to verify.
Okay. Do you find that they're often around like earthquake zones as well?
Well, that is certainly something that I've been looking at. It's interesting where you look at Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's right on this major fault line, but it's also one of the most creative places on the planet. And I've got a working theory that the two may not be actually disconnected. So fault lines. I mean, I've been up an active volcano to compare how I feel at the top of an active volcano compared to an Egyptian temple, because you know you've got a lot of energy flowing around, obviously, in an active volcano. So I wanted to do that as one comparison. So yeah, there's a few different things that we can look at.
And how did it feel?
It certainly had an effect on the state of mind. It was Guatemala where we went up to the top of an active volcano. And, you do tend to start feeling a little bit of spaced out, like in the temples to sort of start with. There's this transition phase. That was one noticeable thing. When you go into the temples in Egypt, you kind of transit from one your sort of normal everyday waking consciousness. And if you know the signs to look for and you just kind of relax and go into this experience, then you can have these sort of deep epiphanies and intuitions. So, I was in a similar state, we can say. So I certainly was affected by the energy flowing around, or certainly the atmosphere of an active volcano at the very least.
And it must have been a little unnerving on top of that.
Well, it was a... It wasn't like it was an active volcano that was exploding kind of thing. It had molten lava just under the surface. So actually, we took some marshmallows up to the top and toasted those over some. But it wasn't like we were watching running lava. It wasn't that kind of level of activity. It was just under the surface where we were at.
Hmm. So I guess one of the obvious questions is, if this was a worldwide acoustic technology, where did it come from?
Well, that is a good question. And unfortunately, so far, I can't tell you where it's come from. I mean, the other authors that I've worked with in the past, they're still working on this question of the age of humanity, and more sites seem to be coming to light to back up the age of Göbekli Tepe, which I'm sure you must have discussed, this site in Turkey that's been...
many times.
Yeah, so there's some sites in Indonesia, Gunung Padang, I think it's pronounced. Yep. So if the megalithic technology, which it appears to be at those sites at that time frame, then perhaps this knowledge of acoustics and the effects on our... consciousness or state of mind also go back that far, but you can only really speculate about it at this point.
Now, do you know if there are any unusual acoustic properties at Göbekli Tepe?
Haven't heard about anything, and it wouldn't, in its current state, because they're these kind of circular enclosures with these big T-shaped pillars that's sticking up in the air. So that's not really the kind of site. It's normally enclosed chambers where I get the best acoustic properties. So unless these buildings had stone ceilings or something that were removed, which looks more like they had wooden coverings or something, and they've rotted away.
Yeah. Hmm. Because I know Robert Schockett said something that these things were so... I think it was Robert who said it, that these things are so thin that they actually seem to vibrate a little bit.
Well, it's certainly possible that they were using some kind of resonance in them, but I haven't actually been down there yet. We were looking at it earlier in the year, and with the, because it's very close, Göbekli Tepe, to the border with Syria.
Yeah.
And it's actually, there's been a few problems quite close or right on top of it. So we had issues getting into Egypt. I was going to go there with my now wife. We were going to go to Egypt in May for our engagement trip. And we got stopped at the gate going to Egypt. So we went to Jordan and Israel instead. Mm. So we've stayed away from Turkey.
Yeah, do you ever get nervous going into those areas at this point?
No, I don't particularly. No, there was some kind of a threat at Karnak Temple, and they actually stopped our plane, stopped. We were at the gate, and wouldn't give us an alternative flight. And it's normally it's the issue with your family. So, I mean, if you tell your family, and my wife told her family, of course they get very scared for your safety. We would have, if it was just us, without impacting anyone else, we would have still gone to Egypt. I mean, something can happen anywhere. But we had a great time in Jerusalem. Very powerful, certainly very powerful. And Jordan was very interesting as well.
Now, you said you're in the south of France right now, and there's a lot of interesting stuff there, isn't there?
Yeah, well, many of your listeners may know... the mysteries around Rennes-le-Château, which is in the area of Languedoc, in the south of France. And it's somewhere it seemed to be a good place for me to go and investigate. It's been very, it's been a big centre of interest to a number of powerful groups through history. So the Cathars, and I mean, they were sort of 13th, 14th century, but they still call it Cathar country. And that was it's hard to classify it exactly. It's been called an offshoot of Christianity. One scholar called it a kind of Western Buddhism group. And also the Templars were in the same area. And then sort of going back further, we've got these megalithic sites, so which are dated again to this 2500, sort of 3000 BC and older timeline. So we went to find one intact 9 meter, which I think is about 30 feet tall, standing stone. Which was up on the top of a very beautiful mountain in the middle of nowhere, because France was covered with a lot of these standing stones, which they call menhirs. But if they're really tall, I think there's been a lot of destruction by humans, certainly. But over this amount of time, there's also been quite a lot of subsidence of the soil. So generally, they tend to topple over if they're that big. So to find one, well, it's 30 feet tall, but I mean, there was quite a lot of it in the earth. So I guess it's visible above it was about 14, 15 feet, something along those lines. But it was on a cliff, so I had to clamber down and go around the base, because there was a lot. I mean, it's a bit hard to tell the difference between natural rock. Was this part of a circle, a stone circle? I was trying to make my mind up, because there were so many other rocks in the area. Or did they just pinpoint this location? So, yeah, we went and saw some dolmens, and they all have the sort of palpable atmospheres, which is what I'm always looking for, these kind of places that are still, we could say, working to some degree. There was one place called the Mound of the Fairies. So why was it named Mound of the Fairies? And that had a very special atmosphere. It just made you feel like you needed to be very quiet and kind of reverential towards Mother Nature, was the general feeling there. So we're going to do a tour next year to this area, because the nature there, and there was another area called Nebius Labyrinth, which got me thinking about these kind of places in a completely different way, because Nebius Labyrinth is basically limestone, again near the top of a mountain, so you get these beautiful views. But the limestone's been weathered. It must be lots of different hardnesses. So a lot of it was very soft limestone. So it's kind of weathered into all of these unusual shapes. And sort of towards the centre of this area, it actually eroded away what I would now have to call a natural temple. It's kind of rectangular shape. And they've, I guess, carved some steps. So you go down these steps into this rectangular shape that's been eroded away. But the forest has grown over the top of this place, and it's a very damp forest, so you've got this moss and lichen growing off a lot of oak trees, so it basically looks like something straight out of Lord of the Rings, the kind of place you'd expect them to be having some important meeting, because it's all very mystical and sort of dark and really incredible. The energy, I mean, if anyone listening enjoys just a walk in the forest, you get this kind of hit after a good walk in the forest. Well, it was that kind of feeling, but amplified quite a number of magnitudes and very heart-opening for both of us. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to taking some people there towards the end of next year, and I hope it has the same effect on them.
Now, you said this one was on the edge of a cliff. Was it always on the edge of a cliff, or did some of the land collapse around it?
Well, I mean, that was the question I was asking myself looking at it. And if we say it's 5,000 years old, then I couldn't find an answer. I went online trying to see if there was some kind of information on how fast cliffs erode to get an idea of how far away it might have been. I haven't managed to speak to a geologist about that one, but certainly not how it looked in its original position, that's for sure. No, and probably it's not going to be there too much longer in geological time.
You're right around the same area that some of these impressive cave paintings are too, aren't you?
Well, that's the other good, interesting aspects of this area in the south of France. So you've got all of these different groups, so it's been very busy area. So we go back to the megalithic times. Okay, we've got these megalithic people, which I've been on the trail of. But then we go back and not too far. I mean, sort of hour and a half or 2 hour drive from where we were in Languedoc, you've got some of these amazing caves. So it's 18,000 year old rock art. And then if you travel over a bit further to the west in France, some of the cave art there is 32,000 years. And then sort of, I guess, about 2 hours south of where we were, just over the border in Spain, there's actually some cave art dated to 40,000 years. And it's also the area that the Neanderthals and the sort of very early stages of our kind, it was very active in that area. So why was that? Well, even today, Rennes-le-Château and the surrounding area is pretty much unspoilt by man. I can't remember being in a landscape that's just so dramatic and beautiful. So you're kind of right on top of the starting mountains of the Pyrenees. We found a lovely little village of 50 people to stay in via Airbnb. Anyone that knows Airbnb, I managed to find an advert and it said also has a meditation room. And I thought, oh, this guy sounds perfect. We can rent his space. So we had a very nice host right on the edge, at a river right at the bottom of the garden where we stayed. And there's just hundreds and hundreds of fish, like one type of fish, hundreds of those, meeting other hundreds of fish in these big shoals. And it's like, wow, when was the last time I saw water that clean that it's got so many fish in? And it's got thermal springs in the area, and also, I would call it sacred springs, but the mineral water that the French Olympic team uses. So these are all the kind of things that we were checking out, because I'm very interested in very pure water, because I definitely get an uplift over just drinking normal mineral water if I can find a fresh spring. And it was very popular, this place, with the locals. They were filling up with sort of 30, 40 bottles at a time. So clear the water, in fact, that if there was just a hair floating on top of it, you saw this shadow moving along on the bottom of the water. It was quite amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
The caves with the cave paintings, do they have any unusual properties to them? I mean, aside from the amazing paintings in them?
Well, I didn't actually, when we came down here, I didn't actually realize that we were so close to it all. And I thought, oh, wow, Lascaux is one of the caves that I'd heard a lot about. But you can't actually get inside the caves that I was looking at in France. Now, there may be some others, but these big ones that have been very popular with tourists, they had sort of 1,200 people a day going into some of them, and it was actually starting to grow mold on the walls and damage the paint.
Mm.
So they've stopped people going in, and this cave I mentioned that was 32,000 years old has never been opened to the public because of a fear of something similar. So the cave art that's just over the border in Spain, from what I know, is open to the public, that was 40,000 years old. So I've got that in my mind as a possible trip in the future, because I'd certainly love to witness it in person and see, yeah, if there is some acoustics or just what my impressions of these places are.
Now, since we've talked, you've been back to Egypt a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you that stands out to you that you've discovered the last few times you went back?
Well, it's really a continuation and sort of further verifying the acoustics with the groups. So I think I've been three times since we last spoke. I did have one particular experience. Because when I seem to carry a lot of stress and tension around the top of my thighs. I mean, for men, it's generally the shoulders, and I think some of us also carry it in the top of the thighs, which doesn't really help my yoga practice. And when I use the acoustics, you know, one of the sites, I think we went to the Giza Plateau and Saqqara, suddenly I had all of this extra flexibility after doing the acoustics. And yeah, so if we're talking about this kind of science of vibration and resonance, and the vibration does penetrate, it actually goes through the body, some of these sound waves. So So I've started to notice that kind of pattern. And there was one lady from Australia that came in, and we were in one of the temples, and we did some chanting, myself and a friend that was on the tour. And she'd had a frozen shoulder, which had completely seized up. She said it had been frozen for about 6 months. And after we did this chanting, she was just kind of standing there and enjoying it. Her shoulder completely freed up. And we've had a few other things like that. I mean, you can't prove it, but for that person at that moment, she said, "Your chanting freed up my shoulder." So that's what it meant to her. But mainly it's these kind of mystical state or this intuitive state that I try to share with the groups to see if people can get in touch with them themselves on a deeper level, and then hopefully continue that when they go home. So I've had lots of nice experiences on that front, sort of continued my research on the acoustics, and it really just pushed me in the direction of this experiential model of working. When we're talking about this self-development, I guess I'd be classified in that kind of area, inner work and that kind of thing. It's all about giving people tools to experience something themselves rather than me telling them this is what it is or this is how it can be. We need to experience something and learn for ourselves. So that's the reason I've launched a new website, Awakening Mentor, which really took on a life of its own. I was just thinking, because I'm a web designer, I'll make a sort of 5 or 6 page website to start with and share as much information on this website that helps me and just see if it helps anybody else. And almost as soon as I started working on it, I think the website grew into sort of 26 pages. It took on a life of its own. And felt like I was facilitating it at some points. So certainly for my creativity and expertise, it grew into something that was far bigger than I would have ever dreamed of creating. So, I mean, I've put as much information on there as possible. It's got various tips, different things that people can try, what I do. I mean, there is the mentor other side of it is if people want me to do something one-on-one, then there's a paid service. But I didn't want one of these websites where you sort of make a lot of promises. Oh, if you contact me and work with me, I'll give you X, Y, Z. Because it's just not what's in my heart. I want to help as many people as possible. And you've got people on this planet with all different, disposable income. Some people don't have enough money, and other people have more than enough. So anyone that thinks I've got something to offer them and has disposable income, they can work with me directly. For all of those other people that don't want to work with me and just want some advice, I've basically put as much on there as I can possibly can at this point. And I'll slowly add to it as time allows.
Okay. Before we get more into the site, we should probably clarify that when we're talking about acoustics and stuff, as you said, it's a vibrational thing. You feel it through the body. It's not just audio.
No, well, I mean, if you take the Great Pyramid, for example, and the King's Chamber, it can also amplify very low sound waves that are actually subaudible. Certainly, I mean, I've got quite a deep voice now, so when I sort of trail off in my chanting, it's sensitive enough to amplify that we wouldn't necessarily hear if I was just next to somebody. So when you get to this very low frequency sound waves, your sense of touch can feel them. I mean, the body, the skin is able to feel these low level sound waves that the ear can't necessarily detect so well, particularly when we get older and the hearing isn't as acute when we're younger.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And were you always sensitive to this stuff?
That I wouldn't give a definite yes. I would say I've always felt a bit different. I don't know if I could quantify it necessarily. I'm quite a sensitive chap. I was an only child. I don't know if that had any impact on it, but I didn't really embrace or know that I could embrace my sensitivity until I started going to my yoga classes. And it was really, yeah, my first major yoga teacher that used to get me to focus inside my body after we did some of these postures and say, can you feel these inner sensations? Because most of us don't look inside the body to see what we can feel. So I got regularly used to looking inside my body after we were doing some of these postures, because she would say that you should be able to feel the energy flow through certain meridians. So like the acupuncture system, some of these yoga postures work on a similar level in her opinion. And you could certainly feel this kind of throbbing sensation and that was beyond probably just blood flowing. So I just got used to looking inside, and one when I took that skill to these ancient sites, I seemed to sort of pick up on this way of just really relaxing into them and feeling this subtle shift of energy in the sort of atmosphere, and it would change my state of mind, which is what I try and encourage others to do. Just sit and be still and see what you feel, because a lot of us don't give ourselves an opportunity.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with Gary Evans.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wherediddtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wherediddtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we're talking with Gary Evans, and we were talking about different acoustics and different sites and stuff, but you've been to a site in California that works with this type of stuff.
Yeah, that's right, because I was helping with the CPAC conference in California in 2014, and we normally run the conference in Palm Springs, and not too far down the road, I guess it took us about 45 minutes to get there, is the Integratron, which is a very well-known, sound healing, I think they call it there. We call it sound therapy now. But it's this large wooden dome. It looks a bit like the type of enclosure you normally see around a nighttime telescope, something that NASA would build. So you have this sort of large, round, white ball that sticks up out of the desert. And so it's got acoustic properties built into it, and they had, I think, about 10 or 12 crystal bowls of various sizes. So when you play the crystal bowl and you get this sort of resonance, because you can feel the sound coming off crystal bowls, if you put your hand close to it, you actually get that physical sensation. So it's-
and before you go on, I just want to clarify to anyone who may not catch what you're saying with the accent. You're saying bowl as in B-O-W-L, not ball as in B-A-L-L.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you normally see these crystal bowls for sale at places like Mount Shasta and Sedona. And I never really understood why they were that interesting before I got into this acoustic subject. But they can have a very calming effect. If you're in this sound frequency that they produce, it kind of comes and goes, this sound. So it's quite interesting. But when you combine it with something like the Integratron, you get an entirely different thing. And I'm actually, the next step is to start running these sound therapy events in the southwest of London, because it's about the experience. I can't convey in this concept what it feels like. It's something that people need to experience and make their own mind up. But I wanted to go to the Integratron, and I wanted to stay conscious, because one of the challenges is that these sound waves are so relaxing that you fall asleep. So at the Integratron, they actually give you a briefing. The guy starts off, well, if you know that you snore when you sleep, please put yourself in a position that doesn't allow you to snore. And if we have a three snore rule or something, if you snore more than three times, the person next to you is entitled to tap you and wake you up. And I thought, well, that's a bit extreme. They don't normally give you this kind of briefing, but I know I certainly quite often fall asleep towards the end. So I thought, I'm going to try and stay conscious and experience it, because it was only about 20 minutes. It was quite a short one, which surprised me as well. And so we started to play, I think one of the larger, they normally play a few at once, so you get these different sound frequencies. So it's a bit like a cocktail. And when he got to a certain point, I was kind of fully conscious, because I think we'd had coffee fairly soon before arriving. So I was in a completely alert state of consciousness, fully present, and he hit this certain sound frequency, and I literally inside my head saw me go from fully awake to completely asleep. And of course then there wasn't anything else to add after that. I couldn't stay awake even though I tried my hardest. It was that powerful.
Wow.
And so when you come out of this state, it's a very, very deeply relaxed state. And my friend and I had the munchies. Those were the main effects of this. Very deeply relaxed, sort of all of our stress had gone away. We didn't have a care in the world apart from we wanted to get a burger. That was the I have a burger as a rare treat, and that was all we could both think about after this. We were so hungry.
Now, what does this ever affect your dreams or anything?
Yes. Yeah, that's one side of sound therapy that's very interesting. So it's more noticeable when you go the first few times. So if you haven't done any sound therapy for a long time, you go to one of these kind of events and you probably have some very interesting dreams. I've always had pleasant dreams, but there's a different quality to the sleep. And also you tend to sleep more deeply, I would say. So it's definitely noticeable, has a noticeable effect on sleep the night after attending.
Hmm. Any like increase in like lucid dreaming or anything like that?
I can't say that I've noticed it, but unfortunately, I used to experience lucid dreams from time to time, and for some reason they've stopped. So perhaps I'm not the best subject.
All right. So you got into this stuff somewhat through yoga. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, well, I have to give a lot of credit to yoga. I mean, that was what turned my life around from... I was an IT recruitment consultant, and I've now traveled hundreds of thousands of miles and guide people to ancient sites, and I'd really have to attribute that to yoga. Opening me up to basically, you could say, going with the flow of life. Or I used to try to be very much in control of everything that I was doing. I have to know what I'm doing next. Like, if I'm going to do something, I want to know I'm going to do it a long time before. And now I'm much more sort of spontaneous, definitely a lot more spontaneous. So I don't need to know everything if I can see the next few steps. So it kind of gave me that ability. And the new website, the foundational texts of yoga, certainly one of the main ones that's generally recognized is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Because another thing that I want to do with my wife is we both want to study as yoga teachers, and ideally in India, but we're still working out how we can fit it into all the other things we're doing. Because we want to share it on the tours that we do, this combination of getting people into a very relaxed state of mind and then taking them to these powerful ancient sites, because that's how they come alive for me. So if we can do the yoga ourselves, then we can really help people on these different levels. So that's kind of one side of it. But also deepening our own knowledge base and our own practice. So I needed to go to the Yoga Sutras and start doing my theory side. I need to understand yoga. And you basically, about, I would say, 5%, I think people normally say, of the Yoga Sutras is actually about the physical side of yoga, which is probably surprising to most people. We normally think of all of these physical postures and people in a class doing yoga. Well, that isn't what the majority of the foundational texts of yoga are about. It's really, if you were to put it into a nutshell, a deep understanding, and I can only imagine thousands of years of observations on how the human mind works. So it's kind of reactions to stimulus, the senses, how the senses affect our mind and the kind of reactions that most of us do. And it's really mind-blowing, because one of the things that I've been trying to get to the bottom of with this search of ancient history is some real deep, what you can call the perennial philosophy, or this wisdom that's passed down through the ages that is as relevant today as it was when it was written. And when I looked around and I saw the great library of Alexandria, so much had been lost there, and so much had been burnt in the conquests of Central and South America with these people that I respected. The Druids were burnt, and pretty much everything was destroyed. So when you try to get to these sources, you don't find anything. And then you come across something like the Yoga Sutras, which is basically something that I thought had been lost. It speaks to my heart in a way that very little else has. So you've got to sort of work at it, because it's a different way of thinking to how we've been educated. But if you're dedicated and you're interested in, you could say, spiritual progress or this inner work, you can see in this text the struggles you've had in the past, the struggles that you've overcome, and it will basically tell you how you overcame them. Those lessons that I had to learn to overcome some of these problems with my mind are all in the book. And then you can find your current place in this process, because it's obviously a huge process. I mean, it's our lives, this massive task that I guess the many Indians would say takes lifetimes. It encapsulates the whole of this spiritual journey up to enlightenment. So it's really a case of, do we trust the source? Does it know what it's talking about? Well, you can verify it knows what it's talking about against our own struggles, our inner struggles, our lives. You can see what you've struggled with in the past. You can see where you're at the moment, because it'll talk about your current struggles with them. Mm-hmm. And what your next, you could say, goals are, or where you can go in the future. So it can put you, give you a signpost of, okay, you've accomplished this, well done, you can see it there, and this is what you can accomplish next if you're sort of determined to dedicate yourself to the task, because it makes it quite clear. The first thing that is needed is dedication, or certainly one of the things, it's that determination is, I want to improve myself, I want to be, you could say, a better person. When you've made that decision, then this text can basically help in a huge way if you embrace it. So it's really, I can compare it to my experiences, and I know what it knows what it's talking about. But the problem is, you need to have progressed somewhat along this self-development path to be able to see that it's talking about the truth. And that's probably why it's overlooked by a lot of people.
Right.
Yeah, you need to have faith that it's reliable. And I'm really just going to be an advocate for it now, because out of everything that I've read, this book really just, it tells you, if you choose to accept. And the other source that's just been of tremendous inspiration is Schwaller de Lubitz, who I've also included on my website. And he's somebody that, again, is very deep, almost impenetrable to most people, and to me most of the time. I need to be at my sort of very best, clearest level of thought to be able to penetrate into what this guy was sharing. And the reason I got so interested in him is Luxor Temple, where I had one of my arguably most life-changing experiences with a group of people. using the sound. He spent 15 years in Luxor studying Luxor Temple, and one of the main things that came out of his time there is what he calls this heart-based emotional intelligence, which is very separate from our kind of rational-minded intelligence. So it's a lot about how important the connection to nature is. So there's many parallels between the Yoga Sutras on one hand and what Shwala de Lubick's found from going into what I can only imagine was something similar to what I experienced, these very deep states of awareness, or where you get these deep epiphanies or intuitive insights into the, you could say, the sort of nature of reality, the inner workings of reality that we don't see on an everyday level. And then I can do a cross analysis, and it's the same stuff. It's the same stuff. People have forgotten how important our connection to nature is. We are a part of nature. We are not separate from that should be dominating. And if we don't spend time in nature, then we are likely to be very stressed, because this real sense of joy and peace and contentment that we get from being in these beautiful natural surroundings. And really, it seems that the system that was being employed back in ancient Egypt was observations of nature. I think the Greeks were made to study 20 years by observing nature, because you can start to understand a lot more about yourself, because we're not separate. It's all this integration. You can understand your own nature by studying Mother Nature. And that's the message, or one of them, coming from Schwaller's work and the Yoga Sutras as well. So spend time in nature. That's the main thing that the message says.
Okay. On the site, you talk about spiritual awakening. And how would you define that to somebody?
Well, one of the major inspirations for the website was, I was going to some groups in London. I was also running some groups, and we tend to do a lot of sharing after doing some of this sound work and different things. So I was hearing from people that have gone through some kind of drastic change in awareness. If we want to call it a spiritual awakening is the term that I went with in the end. So we don't have any sort of religious overtones or something, but some kind of deeper awareness, and you make a lot of life changes, and that's why I listed. I mean, there's a lot of changes that can happen at this point in our lives, but we certainly become much more aware of what we're doing and the impact that we're having on our body, perhaps the impact we're having on other people. That was one of the things that I had from yoga. Suddenly my empathy seemed to be a bit more acute, and I could see how I was affecting other people, and of course wanted to change that for the better. Wasn't always an angel. So it's a huge topic, but some sudden realization. I mean, there's lots of ways it can happen. It can happen from near-death experiences, and you suddenly have this huge realization. I mean, I had some kind of strange group out-of-body experience in Egypt. That was one of my big shifting points, when I realized that it was about the heart, and basically we come from this amazing place of love, and it was really to remember that we came from this incredible place. There's nothing to fear there, and that really the mission's about sharing as much love and being a positive influence while I'm here. I mean, that was the general message, which you see reflected in these near-death experiences. So something very similar to that. So lots of different reasons. I mean, some people just, they get to a certain age, and I mean, looking at the ages, you do have it happening in the 20s. Average age that I've got at the moment is somewhere around 35. People suddenly seem to be thinking about other things apart from worldly distractions. It's hard to generalize too much, because we can all get to the point through so many different ways. But when we get there, we suddenly see all of these changes and start making changes to our lifestyle and the various other things that I've listed.
Okay. The next question just went out of my head. Oh, what are what would you suggest to somebody who wants to pursue this? Obviously, they can look at your website, but what are the first steps to this type of stuff?
On I mean, my path was obviously the yogic one, but if you've had this change in awareness and you want to continue the process moving forward, then the changes that you're probably starting to feel the need to do, yeah, like the diet, some kind of exercise. I mean, if you take up some kind of spiritually minded or based exercise, that's what these systems are designed for. I mean, at the moment, as a cheap alternative, because I like different teachers, yoga teachers or teachers on any subject, just to get a bigger perspective. So I'm regularly using the yoga classes that are on YouTube. So that's a pretty cheap alternative for anyone. There's loads of amazing yoga teachers. You can get sessions 20 minutes, 40 minutes, hour plus. I'm currently working through Kundalini, which is, yeah, about this sort of energization. So that would certainly be one direction. I mean, another part of my journey was visiting these ancient sites and going to these places. They certainly had a profound effect on me. So if people have felt called to Peru, is a very popular one, along with Egypt or Stonehenge, these places can also help us expand, and travel broadens the mind if you can afford to do it. But yeah, otherwise, the time in nature, and follow the sort of grounding techniques and a lot of the tips that I've put on the site. So just get some kind of routine going that fits your schedule, whether that's every day, a couple of times a week, monthly. But it needs to be an active practice. You're a participant in this process if you want to be, and dedicate yourself to it. And the Yoga Sutras makes it quite clear, the more effort that you put in, then the bigger impact you can have on this inner growth and sort of awakening awareness.
Yeah. Now, you talked about Kundalini, and that's something I had a lot of personal experience with, but I didn't know what it was. It just spontaneously awakened in me. And if anyone's interested, I've done an entire show on my experiences, which you can find on the website. But what are your experiences doing the actual Kundalini yoga?
Well, I mean, it's been interesting, even in the past few weeks since we went to this Rennes Le Chateau. I mean, I tend to get these kind of expansion phases. And before, I was doing a lot of this yin-yang yoga, which is the long-held postures and very calming effects. But now I feel much more inclined to do this Kundalini yoga, which is more about really pushing yourself. So in these, I mean, in the videos on YouTube, or you have to do these various postures for 4 to 5 minutes, and it's normally with movement, so you don't just take a shape. And it's very intense, and it's really about going deep within and pushing yourself past that point where you'd normally say, okay, I give up. Because if you can just push yourself past that a little bit and do it regularly, then you can get a lot more of this inner strength. So when you have difficulties in your life and you say, oh, it's too much, this kind of thinking and way of just pushing a little bit further until you accomplish the goal, it really helpful in that kind of respect. But also the kind of breathing techniques, this breath of fire, and basically the energization of the body is definitely helping me be a lot more productive with work. And it's really starting to help me if I've got too much on my mind and there's lots of thoughts in my head. I can feel my energy goes very slow and I feel kind of lethargic and tired. And that's when I need to meditate, and then I can do the Kundalini yoga and really pull myself out of that phase. Whereas before, I was more likely to say, okay, I'm tired, I need a rest. But there are, so it's helping me in that regard. And of course, a lot of core work as well. So, yeah, toning of the body.
Hmm. What's like the most powerful experience you think you've had so far?
An ancient site, you mean?
Well, anywhere, either doing yoga or at an ancient site.
Well, earlier in the year, March, I think it was, March or April this year, I was working with a sound therapist in London. We were doing some events. Well, I've been working on this stimulating the senses. Basically, our senses are how we perceive the world, and if we change enough of the sensory input, I'd already seen that it has this kind of, you could say, mind-altering, or you can change the state of consciousness, mind-altering effect, for the positive, I might add. So we ran this event, and we were using sound and had aromatherapy. So we were changing what people heard, changing what people smell. And we also incorporated colour therapy, so we lit the room. So these are all subtle techniques. But when you combine them together, and we also did some of the ancient Indian techniques, like the chanting and this sort of group work, which can be very powerful. And I was actually doing some cleansing. I've got this Korean shaman rattle, and the rattle can be very cleansing. I mean, not to go into too much detail, but it almost acts like a knife, these bells, when you're... So if you've got a lot of energetic weight that you picked up, perhaps from living in cities, but we do pick up things that we're not aware of, that I'm perhaps a bit more aware of to some degree. So a rattle can really help lighten how you feel, sort of take a bit of the weight that you feel off your shoulders. And so I was going around with this rattle around the group using Palo Santo, which is very popular in South and Central America, used by the shamans for cleansing again. So it's combining these two separate elements. And there was one point when I was just sort of looking at people and doing this cleansing, where it seems like, looking back at it now, my rational mind just completely... switched off, and I was basically looking at people in what I can only liken to looking at them from the state of being, as my, perhaps we'd say, the soul, or this very deep awareness which it seems resides in the heart. And it's not easy to get to that place. You normally kind of get these subtle tastes of it. But during this experience, I mean, I think I ran the workshop, but it had this really profound effect on me. And it happened a couple of times. And it was actually like I was swapping between the two states, because I was kind of looking at the people that I was working on. And then the next minute I know, my kind of rational mind kicked back in, and I almost bumped into people when I was holding the rattle. And this happened a couple of times. And I felt a much greater connection to everybody. Just walking along the street, there was quite a lot of what you can only describe as sort of psychic things happening for the next few days after I'd been in this state. So yeah, I'm hoping to run some more events like that, because other people seem to really enjoy it as well. We had some very nice feedback. A few people said it was definitely consciousness shifting. And in fact, the aromatherapy we were doing, I found that it's supposed to be the highest vibrational aromatherapy oil, which is called Rose Otto. And the company is very small and expensive. But I thought, well, if this is the highest frequency oil, then it could only contribute to this effect with the group combined with these other elements. Now, yeah, I'll definitely give that some credit.
Now, when you say you had some psychic experiences afterwards, what kind of stuff happened to you?
Well, there was one moment when I came out of the tube station, the underground station in the centre of London, and I was actually going in the opposite direction. Everybody basically finished at the office, I assume, and they're all pouring towards the underground station to head home. I mean, hundreds of people. So hundreds of people coming towards me. And I was feeling, very sensitive at the time. And I was looking at their faces and seeing the expressions on a lot of their faces and feeling a lot of empathy towards them. Because, I mean, I used to work in an office and many of them looked very unhappy, very, stressed out. I mean, it's not surprising. They've had a busy day and they're rushing home, so that's kind of what you'd expect. But still, I just felt this huge amount of care towards all these people that I was looking at. And then it started to happen. As I was looking at each person, it was as if I was experiencing their kind of their feeling. This feeling I could see on their face, I was actually feeling as if I was them in this kind of transitory moment. And because there were so many people coming towards me, it was like I was experiencing aspects of all of these different people. So it was something that had never happened to me. It was very strange. But it was, I mean, I've been in yoga classes before and been in these very sort of deeply relaxed states. And one time we all had our eyes closed, and when I opened my eyes, I was actually looking at myself, one of the other people. So I've had, I mean, the reason I go to these ancient sites is to try and find these strange kind of experiences, because I mean, I've accepted that reality is a lot stranger than most of us think. It's not what I'm promoting as the reason to do these things. There's lots of reasons to do these practices, but strange things do happen from time to time. And this was, yeah, definitely added to my list of, oh, that's another weird thing that's happened to me.
Okay. Have you ever done any, like, the sensory deprivation booths or anything?
No. And it's certainly something that I've been considering. I mean, I used to have quite bad claustrophobia, but I think the pyramids in Egypt have helped me get over the worst of that. I've had to squeeze through some pretty small places. I've actually been considering doing one of these kind of flotation tanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because again, it's what I'm talking about, where we're changing a lot of this sensory input and just making it very different to the mind, then you can change into these states. So I could certainly see why those kind of things would be interesting for my research and personal development now.
All right. So give people, you have what, 3 websites at the moment?
3 websites and just about to start working on the 4th, yeah. Yeah, well, the original one back in 2009-10 was Atlantis Evidence, which is basically just lists the biggest smoking guns that there is this chapter in human history that's been forgotten about and that we've been aware, something similar to what we are now for a lot longer than we think. So that was the first one. Infinite Connections, where I've still put my tours and events up. That was my other second website. Awakeningmentor.co.uk, that's the new one that was launched earlier this year. And then starting in a few weeks is holistichealingtherapy.co.uk. And that'll be going into, yeah, a lot more of the kind of experiences and practices that people can join us for and the kind of therapies that we can offer to try and help people directly get a sense of what I'm talking about today.
Awesome. All right. Is there anything else people should know?
Well, if anything that I've talked about today rings a bell, yeah, feel free to get in touch. I'm always happy to talk to people, give them advice if they're traveling somewhere and they want to find certain types of ancient sites, or if they've had experiences with sound, because it's really a peer review process I'm trying to do. It's like the more of us that have input, the more experiences I know that people have had with sound and effects and things, then the more I have to share. So yeah, I have to give credit to the people that have helped me previously. And yeah, if anyone's interested in coming to the south of France in probably September 2016 for we're just going to do this sort of inner journey work, use the power of nature and some of those sites in the south of France, along with some wonderful French cuisine, to see where we can go as a group.
And where can people find out? That's the Infinite Connection site for the tours?
Yeah. I'm just on the final stages of putting the tour together, so that should be up in the next 3 weeks or so, if all goes according to plan.
All right. Well, thank you, Gary.
It was good to have another chat. Thanks for having me back on, and thanks, everyone, for listening.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. As I said, I did a little extra with Gary talking about lost civilizations. That can be found in the patron section. If you're a patron, you will get the link for that, and eventually it'll be in the member section for anyone who becomes a future patron. Already we have stuff up with Peter Robbins, Aaron Gullius, Mike Cleland and a bunch of others. So that's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger. They're short segments, 10 to 15 minutes long, with guests we have on. Nick Redfern's in there. All kinds of stuff. $3 a month gets you access to that stuff, and there'll be much more to come. And we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. This is Whirring World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Cousin Tatriot, chambers number 1597, and counting.